Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Miriam Gershaw, author of the new story collection Survival Tips from Portland's Propeller Books. Miriam's debut novel, The Local News, was a finalist for the 2009 Oregon Book Award in Fiction. Her stories have appeared in the Georgia Review, Gulf Coast, and Black Warrior Review, among other journals. And she's published her flash fiction and creative nonfiction in numerous journals and anthologies. Miriam was also awarded the very first Variant Lit Pizza Prize for her story Lines of Communication, which is included in the new collection. Miriam has taught writing to first graders, retirees, and everyone in between, and currently teaches at the University of Oregon. She was also a good friend and colleague of one of my favorite authors and interview guests, the late Kai Emmons, and we'll definitely talk a bit about Kai, who remains an enduring presence in our lives and, I think, in the lives of all who knew her. Please join us for our conversation with Miriam Gershaw, which is already in progress. Well, Miriam, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios today, your first trip back since, I think, 2009 for Between the Covers. And we're recording this just before your Portland launch event for Survival Tips, so it's an exciting time.
It is. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, let's go back, not to Between the Covers, but a Writer's Digest interview you did in 2010. You mentioned you finished your first story collection several years before that, spent 5 years working on it. After reading one of the stories in a journal, you had an agent contact you, and he asked to see a few of the stories in a synopsis. And he wrote back saying the stories didn't seem all that connected, the collection's theme seemed vague. You weren't quite sure of the theme yourself, but said the stories were about, quote, failures in love. A lot of readers, I think, could relate to that, but the agent thought something else was needed. You weren't quite ready then.
I wasn't quite ready then, and in fact, half of the stories in Survival Tips were in what would eventually become my first collection, including the story that that agent sent the query to me of. I mean, and this is like the thing of myth that you publish in a journal and an agent reaches out to you. I didn't think that really happened, but at the time, I was just sort of learning my way around how to write a story, just figuring out half the stories in here are 25 to 30 pages, and half of them are 2,000 words or fewer. So these 25 to 30 page ones are all from the really early years of my career. So 20, 22,
all
23 years
ago. All the longer ones?
All the longer ones are. I'm sorry, except one.
Oh, which one is that?
Pipelines are not pipes.
Okay, actually.
I'm sorry. Pipelines. Pipelines are pipes.
Are pipes, right. And I love the story, so we'll talk a little bit about that.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm obsessed with cults, so we can talk about that. So so those, part of why I think those are so long is because I think I was writing toward how to write a story, and I was in process doing that. And I think what I was really doing in all those pages is writing toward what I was trying to say. And so there are many other stories from that era and since that didn't make it into here. These are four that I figured out an answer. Like I had something to say and I said it, but it took me 25 or 30 pages. And at the time that the agent reached out to me, I think that I'd maybe written three of the stories that are in here. And I didn't know what connected them truly, because I don't think I knew yet what I was writing about. I was just still, I was a few years out of my MFA program. My reach totally outpaced my grasp. Like I knew what I wanted to do in stories. I knew the writers I loved, but I just kept not being able to do it quite yet. I was still kind of in an apprentice phase of all these new skills presented to me in the MFA years, and I couldn't
You had the vision, not the craft.
I had the vision, not the craft. Or in each story, I was getting a little bit more of it, and I was ramping up and up and up. But the funny thing is, that's how I would still describe this collection. I say this collection is about people who fail at making connections and maybe try again, maybe don't try but understand themselves differently, or succeed. Like, so it's still in a lot of ways, I would say failures in love, but I would use the word love very expansively, not just romantic love, but love in friendships, love
family.
In family, exactly. And I think I would say failures, like I would put failures in a 14-point font and then like in a 10-point font in parentheses, it would say, and successes in love or in relationships.
I actually have my own ideas on the themes, but I wanted to kind of set that up first. And it took me a while, but as I was, after reading the book and then going over the stories, I think I came up with some threads that tie things together.
Oh, I'm so excited to hear them.
Oh, God, I hope I don't disappoint. So getting back to the story of going from that story collection, you then got the advice and support of a colleague and a friend in the Writing Fellowship program, Jesse Lee Kercheval. Yes. And you rewrote the stories and published 6 of the 9 in journals, which got you an enthusiastic agent, a different one than the first one, but the book didn't sell. Your agent said editors loved your writing but weren't interested in a story collection. She suggested you try a novel, and that book, The Local News, took her only 6 days to sell. So talk about publishing myths.
Yes.
I mean, this is incredible. 6 days, that's just amazing. And I was wondering, did you already have the manuscript, or did you start writing the novel after the agent suggested you write one? Could it be more appealing to publishers?
No, I started writing the second she took the story collection out on submission, because I was young and childless. I was relatively young and childless, and how I filled my time was my day job teaching and then writing. And I knew, and so this was the first time, this was the first time I had a book out on submission, and I didn't really know what to do with myself. And so the only self-soothing I knew was writing. So I jumped, after my agent she had also said, you know, it's great to have a novel in the back pocket for, you know, that's what every short story writer knows. A novel is the thing that big publishers want. So I was writing that through the couple of years that the story collection was out on submission. And that worked out well because it was done by the time she had that painful conversation.
And
sold amazingly quickly. I feel like every career, if you're in it long enough, you have a few
success stories.
A few success stories where you didn't have to like pull your hair out and, you know, completely empty your tank and go on, you know, last fumes before you get a yes. There's a few where the yes comes a little bit more easily. And that was one of those times.
Now, the publisher Spiegel & Grau, they bought your novel. That was in 2007, released it 2 years later in February 2009. So over 15 years ago now. And
yes,
that book was a finalist for the 2009 Oregon Book Award in Fiction, specifically the prestigious Ken Kesey Award for the novel. And the award winner that year, ironically enough, was John Raymond, who lives in Portland. He had a story collection called Livability. So that must have been some confirmation that story collections do get published and recognized by the literary world.
Oh, that's so funny. I mean, okay, I knew the whole time that you could sell a story collection,
just
right?
More difficult.
I knew it was possible. However, one editor said of the 9 stories that were in that story collection, these read like first chapters of books and not like standalone stories. And I, my agent at the time was very, very gentle with me and only ever gave me excerpts and then the really nice things people said in rejections so that I didn't understand why they were rejecting me. But that was one thing that came through, and I felt wounded by that. I couldn't let it go. I was so upset. And of course, the reason is because that was true. So when I went back, when I went back to putting together survival tips to send to Propeller, I only picked 4 of the books from that early phase of my career because
for the stories.
For the, yes, because that the other ones were first chapters. I didn't really know how to end them. I didn't know what I was saying yet. They looked good, but they weren't yet complete unto themselves.
So what's the difference between, say, a first chapter or something that looks like a first chapter and something that looks like incomplete stories? Because you have some inconclusive endings here, and you're not alone. A lot of writers do. Some of my very favorite stories are inconclusive or ambiguous, the ending.
My hope, at least, with the inconclusive endings that remain is that the reader in their mind has a pretty dang good sense of what might follow. I hope that I've left enough clues and breadcrumbs that, you know, maybe there's two possibilities, but there's probably really only one, and the reader can see and envision that. Whereas the first chapter of a novel, a good one's a cliffhanger. You don't know what's coming next. So I think what that meant was this: I'm not satisfied. So I'm hoping that my inconclusive endings are satisfying enough in that the reader sort of knows the unbearable next beat that is to come.
Well, here's a question I asked Kai Emmons, and that was for a story collection, Vanishing. So that was in May 2020. I set it up by saying I've talked with several authors who write both short fiction and novels, like Kai. And you.
Yes.
And this is one of my favorite quotes on the difference, and it comes from Karen Russell, who also lives in Portland.
Wonderful. Love her.
And she's published three story collections, one novel and a novella, so quite a few different forms there. And she said, I think stories can haunt you in a very particular way, their velocity and their compactness. I always have the sense, too, with my favorite stories, that the world of the story is still spinning somewhere long after I finish the last page. It stays with you in a different way, I think, than a novel. A story can work on you almost like a poem. You read it in one sustained burst, and it has a different kind of integrity inside you. And then I ask Kai the question, do you relate to Karen's take here on short fiction? So that's my question now for you.
Yes, yeah, very much so. That really resonates. I most regularly reach for a novel off the bookshelf because I want that long, immersive experience, that falling in love with a world and returning to it night after night. But I famously will absolutely love and adore a novel and 2 weeks later not even remember the characters' names. Whereas, like, A Father's Story by André Debus, I got them confused. I have the whole thing in my mind right now, including the devastating last line that was the first short story that made me burst into tears, or the last story from The Things They Carried. That I totally agree that you can hold it wholly inside of you. Susan Minot's Lust, the first short story I read in my 20s, where I thought, oh my God, I want to do this. I don't just want to write a novel. I want to write a short story like this. The economy of it, the emotional velocity, to borrow Russell's word, the depth of it. I loved it so much. So yes, I can hold those wholly.
And when I think of it too, Miriam, short stories, a really good one seems to have much more of an impact than a novel, because you're reading a novel over a period of days, and it might have the greatest ending in the world, but it just kind of, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I was in that world, and now I'm going to be in another world. But I guess like a poem is what Karen was getting at there.
Yeah, I like that so much. And it's almost like you're in a longer relationship with the novel, so what you remember is that longer. It's like you remember the relationship and the feeling of it. At least I do, and I have a horrible memory. I don't remember the specifics. I remember the relationship and the feeling. Even if I remember the ending, I remember the feeling of the ending. Whereas a story, I can glom onto those specifics, and they stay with me.
Now, talking about stories, let's get even shorter stories. Yeah. This summer, you'll be teaching a Willamette Writers Conference masterclass in writing and publishing flash fiction. And you've taught flash fiction in your writing classes. From the podcast interview on Writers Not Writing, it was very recent and I listened to it, it seems you view it as something as an aperitif to kind of wet the palate and open up possibilities for the students.
I do see it as that. One thing I want to say, I'm glad I have the forum to say this. It feels very silly to be teaching what's called a master class on this, because I'm still an apprentice writer in flash fiction. That's part of the joy of it, to be coming into this brand new form. So I'm not a master at it. But
probably a lot more so than any of the students.
Yeah, probably more than any of
them. that was the advice given to me, actually, when I was a student teacher in grad school. I said, I can't do this. You know, I'm standing up in front of these people pretending I have knowledge. I prepared for it.
Yeah.
I don't really know it that well. And they said, well, you know a lot more than the people sitting before you in the class.
So just keep that in mind. That's such a great point.
It got me through.
Yeah, I want those students to know I do know a good deal about it. However, for everybody else in the flash fiction world, I know there's so many more masters out there. So for students, it is such a great low stakes, quick, intuitive writing. I like to throw a lot of different forms, a lot of different options. One of the things I love so much as a writer of flash is that the form of beginning, middle, end gets deconstructed a little in flash, where beginning, middle, we're back to the inconclusive endings. You don't want an inconclusive ending, but you want a middle that makes people stop and go, oh my gosh, that maybe doubles back, that maybe puts you to the edge of a cliff you can peer over. So it is a little bit of a subversive, interrupting kind of a form. So I have all sorts of writers whose flash I use that students can imitate. And it often is, one, freeing, because I make them write them quick and dirty. Okay, we're going to read this, now give it a try. We're going to read this, now give it a try. Because some of my earliest flash fiction workshops, like at the Cleveland Flash Fiction Online Conference, that's what they did. You read, you wrote, you read, you wrote. 4 out of 5 times you might come up with nothing, but the fifth time inspiration hits. You know, you can get a paragraph or two, or maybe even more, in 10 minutes of free writing. And that can be the basis of a good flash. So I think it's great for students in that way. For me, it's been an incredible exercise in getting to the end of things. As much as I struggled with that in these early longer stories, coming to flash, I had such a delightful sense of now knowing what it was I want to say. Not when I sit down, I never know, right, when I sit down. But within a page or two, I know if I have something to say or I don't, and I can do it. So that's been really incredible that it used to take me 30 pages. Now it can take me 3 paragraphs, and I'm saying something.
Is that because you kind of lighten up when you're writing flash fiction, where if you're doing a story or a novel, maybe there's a little bit more pressure on you? Everything has to be, a great literature.
Yes, such a good question. Possibly, but I also think I'm just, you know, I'm nearly 20 years since I wrote my novel draft for the local news, that one way back, and even longer for those stories. I think I've been doing this long enough and also have lived now, you know, I'm in my early 50s. I think I know what I have to say on some intuitive level. I know when something's true on the page, and I used to not know that. I used to think, oh, that's a fun character, or that was a great line, but I wouldn't have a sense of what is it that I'm trying to communicate. I think I just hold that in me more now, but I think you make a good point about maybe the low stakes of flash fiction help me to get there more quickly too.
Now, you have 2 shorter pieces in the book, and from what you said, I guess there's a more recent, too. One gives the book its name. It's called Survival Tips Toddler Birthday Party. That runs about 3 pages in the book, not in manuscript pages. And the final story in the collection, The Book of Adornments, runs about 4. Would you call these stories flash fiction, or some kind of hybrid between a short story and flash fiction?
I would call those flash fiction. Those two I would call flash fiction, because I think they do that structural thing where they take you through a situation, but not a beginning, middle, traditional end of a story. There are a couple medium length ones, like All That Apply and Lines of Communication.
Oh, with the rebuses.
With the rebuses, yes. Which there's going to be an audience participation activity involving the rebuses tonight.
Oh, good.
What I didn't know, I thought, oh, flash fiction is short stories. I'm just going to write things under 2,000 words and submit them. I thought these were all flash in one way or another. It wasn't until I was, again, apprenticing and learning this that a writer made the distinction that a short story has all the similar beginning, middle, end structure of a traditional story, but just shorter. So I think those are short stories. And the two that you identified are true flash fiction in their form and their length.
I'm always interested in how an author sequences. So you selected the stories, and there were quite a few stories you left out. It's always been to me kind of like sequencing songs on a record album when people actually listen to an entire record album. They don't do that in the digital age. How did you go about it? So you have a little girl starting off, and then the Book of Adornments, right? Ending
yes.
The collection.
So there were two ways that I sequenced it. I played around a lot with the newer stories. I like that it's not intuitive to you that there are newer stories and older stories, because that's my hope.
No, not at all.
Because this is either a good or a bad thing that I'm still wading in the same waters as I was when I was in my late 20s and early 30s, that the failures that we all make and the ways we try and try again is the same thing. It interests me still. So one thing I was interested in is braiding the long and the short. Another thing I was interested in is sort of life chronology. Book of Adornments is about a woman who's dealing with the headstone of her dead mom. And a couple years ago in 2020, wow, it's 4 years ago now. That's amazing how that happens.
And the first story, Little Girl, is about a high school girl.
Exactly. Is about a high school girl. So the second story is about a new high school teacher.
Oh, I love that story.
Parker. That one I initially put first because that one won the big literary, like it got the most prestigious publication at the time, and ended up in an award anthology.
That was the Robert Olin Butler Prize Stories of 2008.
Exactly.
I looked that up. 9 stories were selected out of 500 entries.
Yes.
So that's quite an honor.
It was such an honor. And that was one of the stories that I thought, oh, I'm figuring out how to write a story now. So I had put that first. And the other reason I'd put it first is because Little Girl won me an award in the second year of my MFA program, and then it got me a Wisconsin Institute for Creative Writing fellowship. And for a long time, I felt like I'll never write anything better than Little Girl. It became kind of my albatross. And so I intentionally put it second. And Dan DeWeese, who runs Propeller Books, had some great feedback for me when he read the manuscript. And one of them was, why don't we start the collection with Little Girl?
You hadn't thought about that before?
I had thought about it, but I intentionally hadn't done it because I was like, not leading with this story that's already opened so many doors. I wanted to be like, look, my stories can stand on their own without Little Girl leading the way. But I loved the story. It had been so long since I read it. It made sense to me. I think Dan's point was, it's an easier entry story, and I think he's right. And it is a story that, like getting my book published in 6 days, it is a story that came to me essentially in 2 drafts, which has never happened to me. Never. Never before, never since. And it is, you know, it's beautiful in its compactness and what it does by the end and the turns it takes. And I didn't really learn how to write a story with that one because that one just kind of came to me. And maybe that's why it became such an albatross, because it sort of felt like luck. It felt like something I couldn't easily replicate.
A gift.
It was a gift. I was just going to say it was a gift. Yeah, it really was a gift, which I can appreciate now. And I'm happy. I owe a lot to that story, and I am happy for it to be the first story in the collection. Plus, yeah, it's the youngest narrator.
So let's talk about it. The narrator is 16-year-old Sarah, and her best friend's father teaches at a community college and falls in love with one of his students, Angela, who's in her early 20s. Sarah's trying to move out of her little girl phase, hence the title, and does that by making and getting into trouble. When she fantasizes about Angela and her girlfriend's father together, Sarah sees the girlfriend trying to take command as well in the relationship. And this is where I'm starting to see the theme. It establishes a theme for me in some of the stories, many of the stories, where the characters act out as a way of taking control of a situation, and it's not necessarily helpful or a good way of beneficial to that person, but it gives them that sense of control, especially for somebody who's a 16-year-old girl in high school.
Yes. Oh, that's such a nice theme that you picked up on, and I think
I will follow it up with some of the other stories.
Oh, I'm so excited. I mean, I can already click into place other people making similarly bad choices in order to self-soothe.
Exactly, and, yes. That's what I found.
Yeah, I have been long obsessed with high school, so my whole, the local news, it took place in the narrator's 15 going on 16 years. She's looking back at the age of 26. And then my forthcoming novel that's coming out from Regal House next year has three different narrators, but one is a high school girl, and it takes place within a high school.
And you've taught high school students, right?
I have taught high school students, but I mostly teach folks who are just coming out of high school. I mostly teach first-year writing at U of O.
So you teach at U of O now.
Yeah, the 18 and 19-year-olds. So especially fall term, I feel like I am the first teacher who knows their names because they're in small writing classes with me. So they may as well be high schoolers. But I think high school, especially girls, since I was a high school girl, that's sort of the MO, acting out in ways that may not be productive, but that self-soothe. I mean, it's the age where you don't know better yet. So you're trying to do everything you can to get yourself out of uncomfortable situations, and you're 16 or 15 or 17, and you just do whatever you can think of often, which isn't, you know, your brain's still developing. My 14-year-old is sitting in the next room and doing his homework, and he has so much more self-control and motivation and smarts than I had at that age. But he screamed at me because I asked him an uncomfortable question on the way up from the drive from Eugene to Portland today. And I just thought, oh, right, you're screaming at me right now, not because you're a screamer, because he's not, but because you're feeling an intense feeling, your brain's still developing, and you don't know what to do. And I tried not to laugh or smile when he was screaming because that used to drive me crazy. But
right. You don't want to be humored by your parents.
You don't want to be humored by your parents. But I have a deep empathy for that. And I feel like high school students are so great for exploring that theme of making poor choices in order to get yourself out of whatever discomfort you're having in yourself or in a situation. But as you have read, I don't limit that to my high school student characters.
Yes, and the next one, which I told you I already love, and you love quite a bit too, Carker, that follows a young high school teacher, Jonna, who I think is in her 20s. Mm-hmm. And as she's at a parent-teacher conference, she has a difficult student named Carker, whose parents defend him at the conference in disbelief that he's anything but an angel mm-hmm. in the classroom. Carker's refusal in class to reply to Jonna's questions made me think of Melville's short story, Bartleby the Scrivener. And Bartleby was a clerk who turns down requests with a frequent, "I'd prefer not to." I was just wondering if that was an influence or inspiration for Carker.
I mean, that wasn't a direct influence, but the first time I read that story was in grad school, and Carker came out, two or three years later from me. So I think so many influences are just, you know, like swirling around subconsciously, because as soon as you said that, I thought, oh, that's a brilliant comparison. And that sort of maddening lack of expected response that Bartleby and Carker
both give. And it's maddening to everybody around Bartleby and Carker.
Yes.
Yeah, not necessarily to those characters themselves. They seem in their own world.
They're great.
And very in control of that
very
world.
Very in control. Absolutely. And the narrator of that story, you know, that to me, I was writing that in my early 30s. That's a character in the early 20s. But that idea of being at the very beginning of something, a very new teacher,
career.
Right, a new city, a new teacher, that pressure you feel in your early 20s to be good at something already when you're good at nothing, that sense of being in over her head. And she has absent parents, which is something that I like to have in most of my stories. And so she's there with these sort of mawkishly devoted parents and the resentment that comes out from that. And nobody more than Carker makes her aware of the fact that she doesn't yet know what she's not good at her job yet. And of course she's not. She's a young high school teacher. She's not going to be good yet.
But like Sarah in Little Girl, she kind of tries to combat that lack of worth, of knowledge, of ability in doing what she does by lashing out at Carker, which we see that in a flashback in the classroom. And she's tempted to do the same with the parents. We don't actually see it at the end. It's somewhat inconclusive, though I think she's heading in that direction. And again, it's that theme that I picked up after, I don't know if I'm right about this, picked up after reading some of the stories and looking at them and trying to figure out how to talk about them, where she's kind of, again, filling that emptiness or whatever, that insecurity inside by taking control, but in a way that seems or could be very self-destructive to her career.
Absolutely. And the poet John Whitty and Eugene told me when my novel first came out that, okay, now your readers are going to know this work better than you. And at the time I thought, oh, what a silly philosophical poet. No way. This is my baby. I'm going to understand it the best of all. You know, of course, I'm the one that knows that. But so you telling me the themes is a joy. Like there's no right or wrong in what the themes
exactly
are.
Exactly. And I would think every reader might have their own interpretation.
They might. And I do think that there's so much that we can see in Jonna's life that is not working that she, you know, has an awareness of but can't synthesize. When Carker's in the front of the room, in the back of the room, sorry, being unwilling to respond to her, and soon the rest of the class is in on it too.
They do a Carker.
They pull a Carker because they, and I've had this experience as a teacher, when you put a disproportionate amount of attention on one student's negative behavior, that affects every student in the room. You know, it's not surprising that other students want to get in on this drama.
And they've seen what they can get away with, huh? Because Carker does.
They've seen what they can get away with. They've had, especially in high school, they've had a sense of the teacher as the ability that they can break, that they can be out of control. So I think we can see all those factors at play for Jonna, but in the, you know, a bad relationship with her parents, this move across the country, no community, not good at her job. We can see all of lonely, wants to go home with the other parents at the parent-teacher conference. She doesn't want to be alone in her classroom. We can see all these things. All she can see is that Carker is ruining things.
Right.
So that's really satisfying to me.
And she would like to ruin things for Carker.
She'd like to ruin things for Carker because certainly, to me, that feels like that's what human beings do. We don't stand there in this challenging situation and think, I need to get analytical about my parents and my, you know, I need to really dig deep about what's going on. We just want to
get back,
lash out at the person ruining things for us.
Right. And that attempt to take control through destructive and, in Jonna's case, possibly self-destructive behavior also runs through the story Congratulations, Baby. And there the narrator, Bibi, is 30 years old. She's at her friend Jane's house for a baby shower. Jane's pregnant. Bibi's keeping a secret from Jane that Bibi once flirted when she was drunk with Jane's husband, Darren. Not a guy you'd normally flirt with, but Darren hasn't told Jane either. But the secret gives Bibi some sense of satisfaction, of power over Jane. And I love this line. She thinks to herself, it makes me a sliver in the wood of their marriage. I'm embedded. Again, a character trying for control through less than exemplary behavior.
Less than exemplary behavior. And it's Moira is the third character in that triangle that really acts out, that gets drunk and is
yes.
disruptive at the baby shower. But I do think we all live a good ethical life to the best of our abilities, and we all make a series of miscalculations and mistakes and things we regret in our lives. And those miscalculations and mistakes super, super interest me. So the idea that we sort of have Moira, who's the bad guy in the story, the disruptive friend, the friend who, you know, Bibi and Moira are uncomfortable in this suburban home with, it was like, you know, three gals coming up together.
And they don't know the rest of Jane's friends.
They don't know the rest of Jane's friends. Jane's in a different place in her life now. She's
pregnant,
got this
married.
pregnant, married, with a job she likes. She's got suburban friends. She's got a suburban home. She's got a husband she really likes.
Darren.
Darren. While Moira's the active disruptor, Bibi's also struggling with this, and that's where the Darren flirtation in an early draft, the secret was that Bibi and Darren had slept together, and I thought, no, because the story of a friend sleeping with a best friend's husband is that. Mm-hmm. That would be the entire focus of the story. I don't want that.
That's more than a sliver.
But I want Bibi to have Moira's same, like, out of control, like, longing for the three of them to be back in sync and not have Jane sort of quote unquote ahead and settled down and in this whole, and Bibi's in an unfulfilling relationship and trying to figure out how to be an artist. And so that sliver and that flirting with Darren is her figuring out how to keep up with Jane too, how to be a part of this friendship that she doesn't feel a part of anymore. And again, not the best choice.
Now, in the story Big Home, you have a male character this time, Hogan. He works as a relay operator, and I didn't know anything about it, but looked it up. From Wikipedia. It's a confidential, transparent link between hearing and deaf, hard of hearing, and speech-impaired callers. The relay operator voices conversations to voice users and types the conversation to TTY, teletype writer users who can't hear, so the voice doesn't do anything for them. So Hogan, in his role, he's, though transparent, theoretically, is privy to the conversations between these people that he's helping as part of his job. And he falls in love with one of his clients, Lily, who's deaf or hard of hearing, just being a client, and works as a nurse, Hogan finds out, through the conversations at the local hospital. So he's visiting his neighbor in the hospital, and Hogan thinks, after he visits his neighbor, he gets in the elevator, and he thinks Lily gets in there. And it's another somewhat inconclusive, ambiguous ending. And he's about to do something that I think is similar to some of the other characters we discussed, the young women, something that might be very creepy and self-destructive.
I have a little start when you're like, a somewhat ambiguous ending. I think, oh no, are the endings still unclear? But then you go on then you go on to say exactly what you think is going to happen, which is how I wrote it,
But we don't see it. That's what I meant by
inconclusive.
Yeah.
Totally. Absolutely. Like that. But I want you to have the distinct possibility he convinces himself that someone who gets in the elevator is Lily, this woman he's been fantasizing about for months. And the story ends in his head in the moment before he's about to grab a woman by the shoulder in an elevator.
Yeah, we don't see the grabbing, don't know if he goes ahead with it, but...
It's true.
Okay.
I shouldn't have said that. Maybe you should strike that from the record.
I think that fits the theme. Hogan is he's the lone male character in the book to do so, to lash out in this self-destructive behavior just because he's lonely, he's sad, there's an emptiness there.
I mean, it depends on how you classify pipelines or pipes, if he's the lone make.
Oh, that's right. There's Sheldon in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll talk about that.
Okay, great.
So though we can't talk about all the stories, all 10 stories, I'd like to touch on two more. The second one would be pipelines or pipes. But the next one, we already talked a little bit about the lines of communication. You're kind of this hybrid between flash fiction and a short story. And it won the very first Variant Literature Pizza Prize, which was in 2022. I think you got a pizza out of it.
I got a pizza out of it. there was a writer who said to the editors of Variant Lit, wouldn't it be great if there was a pizza prize instead of a pushcart prize? And what we did is we just read stories, and the ones that just like that we got, that filled us, that made us happy, we award those pizzas, and it's the pizza prize instead of the pushcart prizes.
Oh, I love that.
And they delivered me a pizza. They're true to their word, and it was from Sizzle Pie, which had the best vegan pizzas and no longer exists. So I'm like,
here in Portland.
They don't exist in Eugene. I don't know why they closed in Eugene.
I think they're having financial problems. A few closed around here.
But I feel really good that I got it before We got a lot of pizza in our house.
And the story fits that description. It's a playful story, but a very serious intent. It's about the depiction of a marriage gone sour. The married couple in the story, Carla and Edgar, are seeing a marriage counselor, a therapist, who encourages them to open new lines of communication, which Carla does in the form of these rebus puzzles for her husband to decipher. Turns out he's not very good at the puzzles or the marriage, for that matter. I was wondering what inspired you to include the rebus puzzles, which you said at the launch tonight, there'll be a little audience participation for something like that. In a way, it opens up a new line of communication in fiction as a way of telling a story.
It does. You do here. It does. Okay, you mentioned the author, Kai Emmons. She and I, when she passed away a year and
January,
3 months ago.
January 2022, right?
Yes, and that was after 2 years of living.
Or January 2023,
wait,
I think.
No, January 20, yes, we're in 2024. January 2nd, 2023. So she was living with ALS for probably 3 years before that at least, but got diagnosed 2 years before she died. And she and I had been on a writing residency together at Playa in Summer Lake. And one thing that I wanted to do, so she died when she was just before she turned 72. So for her birthday,
which was January 15th, I think.
So for her birthday in January 15th of 2021, I got her a residency together for us to go back to Playa. So we were in side-by-side cabins. She was finishing a draft of her novel, which is now going to be her forthcoming novel, her posthumous novel, The Bells, from Red Hen Press.
Oh, it's called The Bells?
Yes.
Oh, I read some of it in manuscript. It was called Duel,
exactly.
D-U-E-L/D-U-A-L.
Now it's called The Bells.
Oh, good. It's a better title.
I think so, too. Her widower, Paul Calandrino, came up with that title, and it totally fits. So she was writing that in her cabin, and Playa was both of our happy places where you could just sink into the work. And I was, 12 years from selling my last novel, full of a lot of pessimism and just really discouraged. But I had discovered flash fiction very recently, and it had just filled me with new confidence and excitement, and it was this whole new form. And we were only there for 5 days. And on the fourth day, like that night, we're leaving the next morning, I think that the magic of Playa does it. And having Kai next door, and she'd finished her novel draft, and we were all high on creation and flow. It came to me, the idea of a therapist saying, you need to open new lines of communication, and the woman saying, okay, I'm going to start writing rebus puzzles. And I did it. And I wrote a draft of it still there at Playa, and then came back and worked on it, and my son helped me hunt down all the pictures for the rebus puzzles. It was such a fun writing process because I had to figure out, I'm not a rebus puzzle doer. I barely know rebus puzzles, but I had to figure them out. The story got shaped sort of around what I could and couldn't make into a puzzle.
Oh, you mentioned you couldn't do the word careful.
Yes.
In a graphic.
Yeah, exactly. So careful became nice, which is the letter N plus an ice cube. Yeah. So there was all kinds of stuff like that. And it was fun because that then drove the creative mix. When I couldn't come up with careful and had to come up and had to do nice, that made its way into the story. Or I do that at the end. There's like one impossible rebus in there that I'm not going to give away now, but that was part of me trying to figure out a rebus and then thinking, well, no one in the world could possibly get this one because I barely get it. So that was really delightful. And I do think it's the expansiveness of someplace like that that lets you just sort of aim big.
It's a fun story for the reader, too. We get to decipher the rebuses before we know, but it also has a fairly powerful ending there.
I mean, I'm going to say that this story happily stands in the face of people making destructive decisions in order to make their lives more tenable.
It's a healthier decision.
It's a healthier decision.
Maybe the only story in the book that does that. I have to go over each one. But the last one I want to discuss, which we've mentioned quite a few times, are Pipelines Are Pipes. And that takes place at a very strange Seminar for Self-Success weekend run by a guy named Sheldon, who now goes by the pen name Brennan Vivant, and it's a bon vivant a seminar. And it's he goes by the pen, he writes self-help books, and he does these courses. And through alternating paragraphs, we meet some of the seminar participants, and you very concisely tell their stories from their point of view, what they're thinking, the reasons why they're at a seminar like this. At Sheldon's direction, during the story, they all enter a sweat lodge, set up just outside the hotel. Sheldon keeps them there for a very long time until some start screaming, vomiting, passing out, I mean, collapsing totally. And he tries to frame it as a way of letting go of what needs to be let go in each of us. You know, in yoga class, they'll say, let go of whatever doesn't serve you anymore. I've heard that over and over again. And then you'll be able to build a pipeline, which is to your dreams, which is where this comes in. And he has this pipe cleaner metaphor, which goes into the pipeline or pipe title. But again, it seems in line with the collection's theme. There's an emptiness in Sheldon, and I think in each of the characters, and they're trying to fill it in a way that seems more harmful to them than therapeutic.
That's beautifully put. I agree.
What's your story? That's what I got out of it.
That makes me feel really good. I am obsessed with cults, as I said, because I feel like I love watching cult documentaries. And every cult documentary I watch, I think, oh, I would have joined that cult. Because cults are offering a solution to like being mean to your best friend, like as happens in Little Girl, or lashing out at a student's parents, like in Carker. A cult is saying, look, we have the alternative to the existential pain that you're in, or we have the remedy for the impending death of all that we love.
I'm thinking Scientology.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So
we want you to get clear.
So I've always been obsessed. I have many failed novels sit in drawers. Well, not really drawers anymore. They sit in a recycling bin on my computer.
On the computer, yeah.
But one of them was a sham cult leader leading his followers in like a Sheraton ballroom when an earthquake hits. So they all end up trapped in the hotel together, and it takes place over a weekend. And I couldn't pull it off in any way, shape, or form. But this idea of people being drawn into a solution, we're going to give you wholeness. Who wouldn't say yes to we're going to give you wholeness? And this is based on a true story of a cult leader where he set up what he was calling a sweat lodge, which of course was not a sweat lodge, you know, that, and I nod to this in the story. I mean, I make this explicit in the story that this is not a sweat lodge. This is a totally appropriated.
Yes. He has a Native American friend who
tells him not to do this.
Right.
That
please.
This isn't, but some, right, yes. Yeah, exactly. Don't do this. And so, but the idea that people would follow someone into this who's promising them this wholeness. They've spent this weekend with him. Sheldon's looking for wholeness. I mean, Sheldon is looking for the exact same things that everyone following him is, and that you're going to stay there because, oh, I'm sorry. I said that it was based on a true story where bad things happen to people in a sweat lodge. I don't want to give away the story. bad things happen to people in a sweat lodge because this guy who had no business running a quote unquote sweat lodge had this outside of a hotel, and people, you know, people quickly went into heat exhaustion. But I can absolutely see the seduction of it. I'm going to do this thing because it's going to get me out of pain or take me closer to myself. And I'm in this room with like the 40 people doing it. I'm not going to get up and walk out of here.
And okay. Sheldon is just as screwed up, if not more so, than anybody in that seminar.
Absolutely. Which isn't that what you think? I mean, it's what I think when I watch any of the many cult documentaries I've watched. It's just like people just as screwed up, but they've somehow done it more charismatically, or they've like just hooked people in a certain way. Anyway, I feel grateful that among the mistakes and missteps in my life, I never did join a cult.
Now, I want to speak a little bit about Kai. Did you meet when you were both teaching at the University of Oregon? You were both living in Eugene.
We kept missing each other. I graduated, got a fellowship in Wisconsin. She started teaching that year. When I came back the following year, she had known students that I was in the program with because she was teaching the students who were in their second year who were first-year students when I was still at the university. So she had heard about me, and she always contested how we met. But now that she's dead, I get to only tell my version, which is the Fifth Street Market in Eugene. I was walking out of there in the parking lot to my car. She rolled down the window of her car and said, "You're Miriam. Let's be friends." Something like that, which was so kind, so kind, so open. So she wants what she wants, and she makes no apologies for it. And I, of course, knew who she was because she was Kai Emmons and her first book had just come out and she was teaching in the program. But had I seen her in the parking lot first, I would have just like skulked quickly away thinking she had no idea who I was and I didn't want to be embarrassed, you know? So that's how we met. And we were friends.
She has a different account?
Yeah. She remembers this time that I was pregnant with a mutual friend of ours. And she thinks the mutual friend introduced us sitting around that table. But her story makes no sense because she was talking about how she was going to babysit for me and all these things she was going to do with my baby once he was born. And I was thinking, that wasn't a first meeting conversation. We totally knew each other by then. Yeah, her account will not survive her.
Now, Miriam, one last question. Survival Tips was just released last week. But you have a novel, I mean, it's not going to be another 15 years between books here. You have a novel, Closer, coming out next year in June 2025. And that takes place in the fictional college town of Horace, Oregon, which I'm guessing is a little like Eugene.
A little bit.
Which in itself is a fictional college town, if you've ever been there. Can you give us a preview of the new book? And what was it like returning to the novel form for you? But it sounds like you never left it. You've been writing short stories, flash fiction, and novels simultaneously.
Yeah, I never left it. In fact, Closer preceded Survival Tips was written a couple years before Survival Tips. And it's just funny how publishing works that I sold them within a few months of each other, and Survival Tips just ended up coming out more quickly. And there was a 2-year turnaround for Closer. Closer, I think, it's a three different points of view in the story of a community where there's this small-ish racial microaggression in a high school library that cascades and compounds and has all these unexpected and unrelated consequences, really, of these three very different families who are peripherally or directly affected by it in the community. And it's a very Eugene novel, I think, because Eugene is so specific in being this very white but very liberal town. So sort of a weird liberal echo chamber of which I am a part.
But and very sensitive to microaggressions.
And very sensitive to microaggressions. So I was really interested in looking at that through the lens of a bunch of different community members.
And the novel you've been writing, you've been writing novels. You said you have a few on your computer in the not the trash bin, but some kind of archive.
Yes. Yes.
So that's never really left. Short stories, novels, flash fiction, and creative nonfiction. You kind of do everything but poetry, I guess.
Everything but poetry. I don't think I'll ever take on poetry. But yeah, I've done it all, and I find it really I used to be a serial monogamist with novels. Okay, I'm going to write this novel. I'm going to write this novel. I'm going to write this novel. And Flash has sort of broken me of that. Or short stories. There has been a real joy in moving between the two. Whenever I'm doing one really intensively, I feel pulled towards the other because they sort of tickle very different fancies.
And what very extremely different poles there between flash fiction and a novel.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Miriam, thanks so much for talking with us today, coming into KABU. And now we can check if your son Eli has finished his homework.
Yes, we can. Thank you so much.
Eli, we're coming. Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Miriam Gershow, author of the new story collection, Survival Tips, from Portland's Propeller Books. Miriam will be joining four other writers for a coffee talk reading on the theme of grief on Thursday, April 4th. You can find out more about this reading and all of Miriam's work and events online at Miriam Gershow, that's Gershow spelled GERSHOW.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month, usually from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, April 11th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then.